Okay, thank you everybody for joining tonight. Tonight we begin the meat and potatoes, the core, most important, most exciting section of our study on tefillah. While up until now we've been following the order of the siddur, and we began with many later components of the tefillah. From a historical perspective, most of what we have been studying until now has been later developments. While when we approached the brachot of Kriyat Shema, the institution of Kriyat Shema itself was when we finally began to begin discussing the most ancient elements of the tefillah. And as we discovered in the previous shiurim, many of those blessings and benedictions and the order of prayers of the Kriyat Shema are as old as the Beit HaMikdash itself. And many of these practices were practiced in the Beit HaMikdash. And we discussed at length how some of those prayers and practices might have had their births outside of the Beit HaMikdash and been infected into the Beit HaMikdash. So we closed out our study of the Kriyat Shema by studying Emet V'Yatziv and the long bracha that comes after it. And some would call that second section Ezrat Avotenu, which is the section of Geulah. After Geulah, as the Gemara tells us, we have to be Somech Geulah Letfilah. And to be Somech Geulah Letfilah means to juxtapose the bracha, the last bracha of Shmoneh Esrei, which is called Geulah, to the first bracha of Shmoneh Esrei, which in their time was called Tefillah. Just a note about the name. In the time of the Gemara and the Tanaim, Shmonesrei was known as the word as Tefillah. That's what they called it. They didn't call it Amidah. They didn't call it Shmonesrei. As far as we can tell, they called it Hatfilah. And the verb was Lehitpalel, to pray. It isn't until the time of the Gaonim where we find that the Shmonesrei is called Amidah, the standing prayer, to distinguish it from the other prayers, which are done sitting. Or in later times that it's called Shmonesrei. And it's even comical that you find that even a Shmoneh Esrei that has an Amidah that has seven blessings or nine blessings is still called Shmoneh Esrei, despite it not having the 18 or Shmoneh Esrei but brachot that one would expect. Now, the idea of just to give some historical background, this idea of juxtaposing Geulah and Tefillah, Kriyat Shema, and right after it putting the Amidah is not necessarily as early as the Amidah. The evidence that we have from many Gemarot is that in the earlier times, in the times of the Tanaim for sure, and possibly in the time of the Amoraim, many people did not juxtapose the two. And some people would do Kriyat Shema when they could and the Amidah when they could. It wasn't until the Gemara was considered normative that putting them together in an official public worship became the standard and became the norm. So that's just some of the background to where we've been until now. I know we weren't able to learn last week, so I just wanted to refresh everybody. This is where we are. We're taking the course of the Siddur, and we've just approached the section of Shmoneh Esrei, even though it might not have necessarily always been directly connected right after Kriyat Shema. The Shmoneh Esrei is an institution which is the formative institution of Jewish liturgy. It is the most important, the most central part of our liturgy. And so it does deserve, and it always deserved, the largest amount of study. Tonight, we're going to be summarizing roughly dozens of books, hundreds of thousands of words of research. We're going to begin by summarizing all of this data that we have. And again, I'm apologizing in advance. We could do this in 18 shurim, 19 shurim if we wanted to, but we can't touch on everything. And we're just going to do the Rosh Prakim, right? The heads of the chapters. We're going to do the cliff notes, and we're going to go through most of what we can learn about Shmoneh Esrei in the limited time that we have. But I want to give everybody a higher level understanding of what the Shmoneh Esrei is, where it came from, who composed it, why, and when. So now, the birth of liturgy itself is wrapped up in the history of Rabbinic Judaism. Anybody who has studied Rabbinic Judaism academically, has touched on rabbinic history and has therefore touched on the Amidah, even if they don't specialize in liturgy. Now, one of the best tools that we have for studying liturgy is asking questions. The most important question we ask when we're confronted with any liturgy that's standardized in the Jewish corpus today is the question of what motivations were there to compose this prayer, and what motivations were there for people to continue saying this prayer? Now, that's a very general question, because the answer to that question, the second question, can be very different than the first, and it could be very different in different generations. What motivated people to compose a prayer might not be the motivation for them to say it 500 years later. So both questions are equally important. And in order to begin with answering these questions, why did they compose the Shmoneh Esrei, who did it, and what motivations were behind it and were behind people continuing to say it, we have to start with the data. And we're going to start with the earliest evidence available to us. So this is going to begin with a study of a few famous Gemarot, few passages in Talmud, and then we are going to move on from this slowly to mentioning many other areas of Chazal. Now, we won't be going in depth to all the Toseftas and all the Breitot and all the Midrashim tonight. As we go piecemeal through the Shmoneh Esrei, we will touch upon each one when it's relevant. So let's start with this Gemara Brachot of Chavchet Amud Bet. Tanu Rabbanan, Shimon Hapakoli Histir Shmoneh Esrei Brachot of Neir Megamliel al HaSeder B'Yavne. Amar Lehen Megamliel HaChachamim Klumi Yesh Adam Shudeh LaTikein Berkat Minim Amad Shmolah Katan V'Tikna. Right, so Shimon the flax worker, an otherwise unknown person in rabbinic writings, arranged the 18 blessings in front of Rabbi Gamliel at the assembly, the synod of Yavne, right? This is to Christians known as the Council of Yamnia, of Jamnia. Amar lehen Rabbi Gamliel lechachamim, klum yesh adam liyeshedel letekim berkat minim. Is there anybody who knows how to institute a blessing against the heretics, which was clearly a problem at that time that they were responding to? Amad Shmuel HaKatan v'tikna. Shmuel HaKatan, one of the most pious men, got up and wrote the bracha l'shana acharet shechacha, and the next year he forgot it. And the rest of that story will continue when we discuss the Birkat HaMinim. The next Gemara is in Megillah, very similar Gemara, Tefillah Min Alan. It says, how do we know that Tefillah is, how do we know that the Shmoneh Esrei has a deliberate order? Titania, Shimon Bakoli is Tishmona Se Rachot of Nebring Lial Seder Biavne. Amr Biochan Vamri Labi Martita Tanar. Biochan said, and some say that it's actually a Brisa, may have assumed the Kenim, 120 elders, Ubahem Kamanivim, and among them many prophets. This means the Ache Knesset Agdola, Tiknu Shmona Se Rachot al Seder. They were the ones who instituted it according to its arranged order. Now, the Gemara sees the contradiction here. Wait. The Ache Knesset Sakadela are at the very beginning of the second Beis HaMikdash, or, you know, depending on how you date it, at the end of the first, all the way to the begin, to the beginning of the second, and Shimon Hapakoli lived in the first century, which is roughly 500 years later. So the Gemara is faced with a historical discrepancy, but as we're going to see, the Gemara doesn't really care about history. The Talmud, as we know it, never really considers history to be an important agenda. The way the Gemara works is that the Gemara is mostly primarily concerned with the law of the Torah. It's concerned with proper transmission. And the contradiction here is really objected to and challenged because it's trying to reconcile two different traditions. So saying, wait, how could I have a brisa that says this and I have another brisa that says that? So the Gemara says, Shimon Pikoli, my history, what could he be arranged if it was already arranged by the Ache Knesset Gedola? So Gemara answers, well, we could resolve this by saying Shechachum Bechazer V'Sidrum. Perhaps they forgot the order of the 18 Brachot, and it was then restored by Shimon Pikoli, who rearranged them. Okay, this is the earliest data of the Gemara that we have from this time. Now, the issue with this history that's before us here is that if you look at the sources from the Tanaim, there is zero evidence, or not even just the Tanaim. If you look at the evidence from Jewish sources and non-Jewish sources, there is zero evidence for anything resembling the Amidah, Shmoneh Esrei, a fixed liturgy, a fixed order of liturgy from the time of the Ache Knesset HaGedola. There's just nothing, and onwards, during the entire Temple period, we have no evidence that such a thing existed. And the idea that only one person remembered the entire Mesorah, and he was the one who restored it in front of the council at Yavne, is far-fetched. The actual language of the Braita doesn't say that he restored it. It said that he arranged it. So this reconciliation of the Gemara has not satisfied scholars going forward. Whether you go to the Rishonim, whether you go to the Achronim, many scholars have not been fully satisfied with this answer. It is a convenient reconciliation. It does make the two brises not contradict each other, but it isn't historical, nor does the Gemara care for the history. The Gemara is saying there's probably a middle ground. There's probably some middle truth here. The Shemona Esrei was instituted by the men of the Great Assembly, and much later, it was finalized or canonized by the men of the Assembly at Yavne 500 years later. That seems to be the Gemara's objective, just to reconcile the brises and move forward. It doesn't seem to care about the history itself. The Gemara famously says, "Mai dehave have." When it talks about history, the Gemara says, what happened, happened. The history itself is not important. The only time history is important to the Chachamim is when it's part of what scholars call a sacred myth. It's part of our holy history, like Yitziat Mitzrayim or Kabbalat HaTorah, things that really directly pertain to our praxis, directly pertain to our core values and our core practice. Those are the things that Chazal cares about, and those are the things that the rabbis were concerned with. But history for the sake of history is not something that the Gemara is concerned about. So now let's take this data that we have, and especially the most plausible data, which is the attribution of it to Rabbi Gamliel and Yavne, and let's see where this leads us. So we're gonna need to take a bit of a brief detour into some history in case anybody here is not familiar with the history. So first of all, who was Rabbi Gamliel? Rabbi Gamliel was the son of Rabbi Shimon, and Rabbi Shimon the first. And Rabbi Gamliel was a leader of the Jewish people after the destruction of the Second Temple in the year 70. Now, the destruction of the Jewish Temple in the year 70 is one of the consequences of the Jewish-Roman War that occurred between the year 66, roughly between the years 66 and 74. The war began with a revolt in Jerusalem over discontent over the government, whether it was taxes, whether it was the treatment of the Jewish citizens, the Roman citizens. There was much dissatisfaction with the Roman government within Jerusalem and within Eretz Yisrael as a whole. Now, the tensions and the infighting between the Jews and the infighting between the fighting between the Jews and the Roman governors of the locale eventually boiled over to a point where the Jews humiliated the local Roman, I forgot the name of it, not procurator, one of the local Roman officials chased out a whole bunch of Roman guards. And what's his name? The general, Cestius Gallius, does anybody remember precisely his name? I'll just pull it up for a second because my memory of history is not there. Yeah, Cestius Gallius. He arrived in Israel. He was the governor and the general from Syria, from the consulate in Syria. He arrived in Israel with a legion of roughly 6,000 men. The Jews, with their ingenuity, managed to ambush this force and wiped out an entire Roman legion with 6,000 men. Cestius Gallius managed to escape with his life, but the rest of the legion was humiliated and decimated, and 6,000 Roman soldiers lost their lives. This shocked the Roman Empire. From one side to the other, shook the entire Roman Empire. How could this sliver of land, how could this tiny minority nobody Jews go ahead and humiliate the power of the Rome and the glory of the Roman Empire? Such a thing was unheard of. And it confused them, it shocked them, and it led them to send a retaliatory restorative force to Jerusalem. Tens of thousands of men were sent to go crush the rebellion. Now, this culminated with the sending of a professional general named Vespasian, who was not just going to come and mess around. He was going to come, do this right, take his time, and crush the Jews. So one of the legends that the Gemara tells us about this general Vespasian is that he met with the Rebbe of Rabbi Gamliel. Rabbi Gamliel's Rebbe's name was Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. As Vespasian besieged Jerusalem, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai smuggled himself out of the city. You see, the Jews were the I keep saying this in a third person, but we are Jewish. The Jews at the time, I'm sorry, just trying to say this in the historical sense. The Jews at the time, the Jews in Jerusalem were incredibly capable, incredibly fierce fighters, and incredibly capable of destroying and actually going to battle with the Romans. On more than one occasion, they actually fought back against the camped legion outside of the walls and actually managed to score some victories against the army outside of their walls. It was really only due to the infighting of the Jews and the fact that they couldn't form a unified cause and unified government that they lost to the Romans. And this is most historians would agree that it was the disunity that made them lose the war, not their lack of military capability. Now, because of this infighting, Rehoboam and Zakkai realized that they were going to lose. Without unity, without a clear vision, and without the acceptance that the Roman government was, you know, overall tolerant of the Jews, he realized that this was a lost cause and Jerusalem would fall. So he went and he smuggled himself to the Emperor Vespasian, and he said, I have a message for you. I want to talk to you. He wanted to negotiate. And the Gemara says that he predicted that the Vespasian was going to become the emperor. And as he's speaking with Vespasian, the emperor Nero had died, and the messenger just arrived to tell Nero that the council, that the senators have elected you to be the next emperor. And in his amazement, Vespasian gives Rehoboam ben Zakkai three wishes, gives him a wish, tells him, what could I do for you? And he tells him as follows. He says, give me Yavne and its scholars. Give me the dynasty of Rabbi Gamliel, Vasvatan the Messiah, Leib Tzadik, and please give me doctors to heal Rabbi Tzadik, which is a story for another time. Now, the reason this was so important was because Rabbi Yehuda Mizakai had the foreknowledge and the foresight to understand that the Sanhedrin had to be relocated, that the Jewish people needed leadership, and that Rabbi Gamliel, who came from Hillel, which in turn came from the family of David HaMelech, could be appointed as Nisim. And he wanted the families of the Gamliels, the Gamliel Shimon, that entire family to be preserved because they were fierce and capable leaders who could lead Klal Yisrael after the Churban. Therefore, Rabbi Gamliel took over after the destruction in the year 70. The scholars moved to Yavne safely with the Roman escort, and they assumed leadership as a quasi form of Sanhedrin and took over the leadership of Klal Yisrael at the time. Rabbi Gamliel essentially, Rabbi Yochanan stepped down from his duties and he let Rabbi Gamliel take over the status as the leader of the Chachamim in Yavne. And Rabbi Gamliel was, as a personality, he was from the elite. To be quite honest, Rabbi Gamliel believed in classism. He was a classist person. He believed that there were classes of people. Doesn't mean he wasn't humble. He was an extremely humble person. And as is testified from many stories in the Gemara, he was incredible. He had demonstrated incredible humility and willingness to admit that he was wrong. However, even if he could admit that he was wrong, he saw that, and he understood that Judaism needed strong leadership. Now that the temple, which was the center of Jewish worship, had been decimated, the Jewish people needed a unifying theology. They needed a unifying cause. They needed a unifying identity. And he could not stand any fractures in the Jewish people. And therefore, he sought and he endeavored to unify the Jewish people under one law as much as possible and under one ritual as much as possible. And with the assembly at Yavne, he accomplished many of those things. Some of the most famous ones was that they began redacting parts of the Mishnah. They began finalizing many laws. Legend has it, but it's probably not true, that they canonized some of the books of the Tanakh and said these books are ksuvim, these books are not. They had many projects to undergo in Yavne. One of the most important and one of the most consequential was the establishment of a fixed liturgy. And this accomplishment was not creating something from nothing. He was responding to a need. Once the center of worship had fallen, all the Jews were up until now paying their maxis hashekel or bringing karbanos were lost. They're like, how do we have a covenantal relationship with our God? How do we have a relationship of our God with love and an intimate relationship with this transcendent God if we don't have a place and a way to serve him? Therefore, Rabbi Gamliel saw it as imperative to invent a new type of worship. And this type of worship does not include sacrifice. It does not include incense. It does not include lots of ritual. And this is a completely innovative and new form of worship, which was just verbal. And an assembly, a minion of people are going to get together, 10 men are going to get together or more, and led by a precentor, by a shliach tzibur, they were going to pray to God. This idea of Rabbi Gamliel cannot be underestimated. This idea itself is revolutionary. And the idea is not just revolutionary because it is, and I'll just give you an example here, because it's revolutionary to Judaism, but also because the, if I could bring this up for you in a second, hold up. Yeah, here we go. Just going to try to share my screen one more time. Give me a second. This was revolutionary because it didn't just affect Judaism. It also affected the daughters of Judaism, such as the children, like Christianity and Islam. For example, in the first or second century, one of the Christian laws in the Didache, which is a Christian Greek work of Christians from the first or second century, they are already telling people to say the Lord's Prayer, which is the prayer of Jesus that he told his disciples, that this is how you pray, three times a day, which is their parallel to the Amidah. They were inventing a form. The Christians were trying to model a form of public worship after the known type of public worship that they were familiar with from the Jews before them. Not that Christian liturgy is similar to Jewish liturgy. It is not. And yes, the original Jewish Christians were Jews and did daven in the same synagogues as Jews, but that was the reference point. And because they were in synagogues, because they were under this edict, they were under this institution of Rabbi Gamliel, this was their frame of reference. And Judaism invented a form of prayer that for the next 2,000 years would become standard, where you could appeal to a transcendent God with a verbal or a meditative communal worship and service that didn't have to require a temple, didn't have to require an incense, an offering, anything like that, or a place. It could be any place, any person, any time could establish his relationship with God. All God wants is your heart. All God wants is your presence. Your heart and the community and your community together can come before God and pray to him. That was Rabbi Gamliel's innovation. Now, it wasn't, however, an original, completely original invention. We know that it wasn't completely revolutionary. And how do we know this? Well, first of all, let's see where we could go. One second, let me just share my screen one more time to finish the slides. Sorry if you're listening on the audio, this is just a little bit confusing. When I have two screens, it's easier for me to demonstrate the slides. This here is, that was Vespasian. This is a mock-up, a 3D rendering of Rome. The reason I brought this image is because there's a medrash that says that when Rabbi Gamliel traveled, one of his many missions for the assembly at Yavne, besides all his other things, was to reconcile with the Roman government. And he had this trip where he, with other Chachamim, he traveled to Rome. And the site of the metropolis of Rome at the time was so magnificent and so overwhelming that he and the other rabbis began to cry at the disparity between Rome and Yerushalayim. It was really a tremendous, he was a tremendously sensitive person. And the plight of Yerushalayim was always foremost on his mind. Okay, now how do we know it wasn't completely revolutionary? So first of all, we know for sure that the Gemara's own history is that the Gemara claims, and there's a Braisa that thinks that the institution of prayers goes as far back as the Anshei Knesset HaGedolah, which means that all the Jews accepted that this was plausible in that time. They accepted that it was plausible, and they accepted that it was likely that the prayer of Shemoneh Esrei is more ancient, or the prayer of Amidah is more ancient than Rabbi Gamliel. Second of all, Rabbi Gamliel himself has arguments with other Tanaim about the halachas of Shemoneh Esrei, such as, do you need a shliach tzibur? Who's more important, the shliach tzibur or the yachid? We have which doesn't make any sense. Like, wait a second, you're arguing whether or not, you made the takana. Like, if you made the takana, why are you arguing whether or not the shliach tzibur is mighty people or not? That's your business. You made the takana of a shliach tzibur, then you should be the one who's explaining how the chayva works. It must be that the idea of shliach tzibur and assembly worship predated him. Next, we know that Beis Hillel and Beis Shammai have a machlekes, have a disagreement about how many brachos to have in the prayers of Yom Tov and in the prayers of Rosh Hashanah. And they list the numbers, six or seven. There must have been a series of brachos such as an Amidah that was said in the Beis HaMikdash before the Shemina Esrei, the blessings of 18 existed. So clearly, Beis HaMikdash Beis Hillel, who lived in the time of the temple of the second bias, had something similar to a fixed liturgy, let's call it. Even if it's not an Amidah or Shemona Esrei, something like that. Lastly, we also know that synagogues existed in the time of the Second Temple. Most of the evidence that we have seems to point to the idea that synagogues were used for the reading of the Torah and the dissemination of the law and as a town hall. But we do know that it's likely that the synagogues also developed around the reading of the law, around the reading of the Torah, Kriyas HaTorah, also blessings and benedictions, and other types of liturgy. So we know that synagogue existed. We know fixed liturgies existed. We know that brachos existed. And we know that the idea of a shliach tzibur existed. So clearly not everything he was doing was revolutionary. However, it was extremely innovative in its own way, because it was giving the Jewish people a new way of worship and unifying them under a core mission and a core covenant with God. It was giving them a new way to understand that they could still have a relationship with Hashem, even though the Beis HaMikdash wasn't around. Now, this was based primarily on Torah and its law, but also anchored in tefillah, which brought people closer and kept people close to Hashem throughout the exile. Okay, so what is the innovation exactly if it wasn't revolutionary? So in the Rishonim, we have a bunch of different theories. The Rambam himself holds, well, Rishon Gamliel did nothing. The Rambam holds it was all the Anshei Knesset HaGedolah, Ezra Nechemia. They instituted Shemayna Esrei down to the letter because they wanted a Hebrew prayer and it had to be in Lashon HaKodesh, and they told everybody to do it in Lashon HaKodesh, and Rav Shimon HaPikoli and Rav Gamliel B'Yavneh. The only thing they added was the Berachas Aminim, and they reinstituted that it had to be a Chayva from now on, and you had to do it three times a day. That's the Rambam. Do it three times a day. Do the thing that the Anshei Knesset HaGedolah created, but do it three times a day. And now it's a Chayva and add Berachas Aminim. The Abu Dirham holds, no, he only fixed the order. Well, before that, there was no Seder to the Brachos. And Rav Gamliel said it had to be Al HaSeder. There had to be a specific order. Avais, Gevuris, Kedushais, Das, etc. And finally, Chassidei Ashkenaz hold, no, it all began in the time of the Anshei Knesset HaGedolah. And they composed it down to the letter. Shimon HaPikoli was merely repeating it because he remembered the exact Messiah. He was the last man alive who knew the exact word for word. And Berachas Aminim was added afterwards as a 19th. Now let's move on to the history of academic scholarship, and we're going to do as much as we can with the limited time constraints. Okay, so now the first school of academics who studied Jewish liturgy came to it with their own ideas, because I shouldn't say their own ideas, but with their own training. Now, the Wissenschaft des Judentums, which is a movement in Germany, produced some great scholars of Jewish history and of Jewish literature, most notably Leopold Zunz, or Yom Tiv Zunz, and Ismar Elbogen. And both of these people, for interesting historical reasons, were trained philologists, meaning they were experts at text and literature and unpacking the layers of text and literature to get yourself back to an Urtext or an original text. If you take the writings of the Greeks, the writings of the Romans, any ancient writings, and you look at the various recensions of them, the various different versions from different centuries, you can find and peel back layers to when the original text was composed, especially if it's a work of poetry, you know there was one author. So if you peel it back, you could usually, with great skill and great method, you could peel it back to find the original text. Now, the way the philologists generally think and the way they study liturgy is very much like a literature. Now, that has its downsides, because liturgy is much more than a literature. It's not just a text. I mean, we know that tefillah is not the siddur. Siddur is not the tefillah. Tefillah is something we do. It's not something we just say. It's not just the words in a book. Worship includes much more than just a text. Worship has ritual. Worship has meditation. Worship has community. Worship has theology. There's so much more to tefillah than just a text. But their training makes them think about the tefillah like a text. And the way they approached the Shemayin Esrei was as philologists. They look at it and they say, well, the evidence we have points to some of these brachos being composed before Rabbi Gamliel B'Yavneh, some of them being composed during, and some of them after. Essentially, they discount the entire history. For example, Elbogen sees the entire history of the Gemaras. He rejects it. It's not common sense. Get out of here. But then he admits that the Gemara is kind of sort of right anyway. He believes that it wasn't Gamaliel Biavne who instituted everything out of nowhere. Rather, he believes that some of these brachas were composed in the temple era. And there were certain social groups and different areas, different rabbanim, different sects of Judaism, people in the Beis HaMikdash, people in the synagogues, who composed different blessings. Now, over time, different blessings were added for different needs. The way philologists see it is that every era has its own responses. And so what, for example, when he looks at the Shemayin Esrei, he'll look at Re'ena Be'onyenu, see God in our oppression, and he'll ask, wait a second, who would have asked for a God for a blessing of oppression? Or if you look in the Baruch of Al Tzadikim, Al Chassidim, Al Sheris, Amacha Beis Yisrael, who are these people? Who are the Geri HaTzedek? Who are the Pleitas Beis Ephraim? He wants to know what era added this bracha. And for him, it's a series of edicts. For him, it's one takana after another, and they add blessing after blessing until finally Rabbi Gamliel and his later Tanoim come and they fix it at around 18 blessings. And I say around because the Bavli has 18, the Bavli has 19, and the what's it called? Yerushalmi has 18, right? Bavli is 19, Yerushalmi is 18. So that's his way of seeing it. He believes that the Shemayin Esrei was developed gradually, piecemeal, edict after edict, which finally got formally put together in Yavne into roughly 18 or 19, even though the blessings existed, some of them, like Ritzei, all the way from the temple, and some of them came after Rabbi Gamliel B'Yavne. Or they were, I should say, created as their own bracha later than Rabbi Gamliel B'Yavne. Then comes the form critical school. And someone like Rabbi Yosef Heinemann doesn't disagree with Elbogen on every aspect here. Elbogen himself stresses the importance of the social context, that there were different social groups, different sects, different rabbis, different tanoim throughout Eretz Yisrael that were all composing prayers at the same time. What Heinemann stresses is that we have to study prayer from a form-critical perspective. You have to look at the forms of the tefillahs, look at what type of tefillah is this, and then divide them into categories. He doesn't see the formation of the Shemayin Esrei as a series of edicts, one after the other. He sees it as different social circles developing their own prayers and prayer genres themselves. And you cannot see the Amidah as being a sequence of edicts. Rather, every circle developed their own collections of brachos. And eventually, those collections of brachos got expanded and more expanded. The best ones began being added to the synagogue prayers. And finally, Rabbi Gamliel decided that there should be a specific order to those prayers. As the different social groups in Eretz Yisrael were composing different blessings, he decided, Rabbi Gamliel and Yavne decided that certain blessings, certain topics had to be said in a specific order. And we had to do 18 of them. The number 18 was important, and they have to be done in this order. But it was not a takana after takana after takana. It was one takana which established the order of brachos that grew organically out of the many social circles in Eretz Yisrael at the time. That's the very simplified version of Yosef Heinemann. He also demonstrates, for example, how in the temple, in the Beis HaMikdash, there was the bracha form and the doxology form. And what happened after the destruction is that Judaism adopted the bracha form and Christianity adopted the doxology form, which is more of a praise type of form, which it would be more familiar to any Christians who or anybody who understands Christian prayer. Okay, so this is the state of affairs until roughly the year 1989, 1990. Most scholars began to become complacent with Rabbi Yosef Heinemann's way of looking at things. Rabbi Yosef Heinemann says the early history is very murky. There's a lot of different development, and there is some era of fixity, but the beginning era is very murky, and the origins should and could remain murky. Ezra Fleischer enters the scene. Who is Ezra Fleischer? Ezra Fleischer was the titan of the study of Hebrew poetry, of Piyut. To call Ezra Fleischer a genius and a tower would be an understatement. The man was an unbelievable titan of Jewish scholarship. And he was just a computer and a scholar of a walking, talking computer, a scholar of impossible genius. And he decided at the end of his life, the last maybe 20 years, to move a little bit out of poetry and start studying liturgy as well. And he disagreed sharply with Rabbi Yosef Heinemann. And he took the traditionalist view, and a shock to everybody in Eretz Yisrael. All the academics in Eretz Yisrael were shocked, because here was Ezra Fleischer taking the view, essentially, of the, of, let's call it, who would that be? Would it be the Rambam? The Hasidic Ashkenaz. He took the most hardcore traditionalist view, and he argues as follows. He says, we have, first of all, no evidence for anything like a Shemaina Esrei, right? A three-time a prayer, three-time-a-day prayer being done by Jewish people anywhere, from the Jews or the non-Jews. No evidence of this happening before the destruction, right? Then we have a Braisa about Rav Gamliel b'Yavne. No evidence before of Shemaina Esrei before Yavne, only evidence after Yavne. We have Rav Gamliel being Masakin, a Chayva, an obligation, three times a day, right? Shachas Mincha Ma'ariv. In Hebrew, in a specific order. How could you suddenly, if you were a rabbi, is it possible that you could create a new institution, a new obligation on everybody in Klal Yisrael, and not give a fixed text? How is that possible? You're telling everybody, just pray something with 18 blessings? How is that even possible? It isn't possible. And in his view, it's necessary logically to say that Rabbi Gamliel b'Yavne didn't just decide on an order. If you're going to make the entire Jewish nation follow your obligation, your chayva, your tefillas chayva, it must be that there was a fixed text. Why is it that we have variations afterwards? Only because of poetic aberrations, and that over time the original text became forgotten. But he believes it was a yesh me'ayin, it was a something from nothing, that Rabbi Gamliel not that there was no such brachas beforehand, not that Jews didn't pray beforehand, but Rabbi Gamliel created and wrote the Shemaina Esrei and its nusach from start to finish in Yavne. Yes, he borrowed prayer styles from beforehand. Yes, Jews prayed in assemblies beforehand. Yes, there were series of brachos said beforehand, but Shemaina Esrei must have been an invention and a composition of the synod, the council of Yavne. This is Ezra Fleischer's contribution. It's based on earlier work by Shlomo Zeitlin and Yisrael Levin, but this is his thesis. And this explains many languages. It explains many other problems that other scholars were having. And he says this also explains why the Nusach HaBavli is better than the Nusach HaYerushalmi and more consistent. We don't have the exact version that they did in Yavne, but it's our version today is built upon that original version. Now, no one in Eretz Yisrael was willing to argue with Ezra Fleischer, but his stature and his force of personality made a lot of people scared. If you actually read his drasha, it's incredibly, incredibly well founded. He has an enormous amount of scholarship. There's a tremendous amount let's not call it evidence, but comparisons and proof, and there's, it's a very forceful argument, and many people were afraid to argue with him within Eretz Yisrael itself. However, outside of Eretz Yisrael, in America and in England and in other places, the scholars really weren't afraid of him. Like, what are you going to do to us academically? You're not exactly going to threaten my job at Oxford if I argue with you publicly. So outside of Eretz Yisrael was where people began to take issue with Ezra Fleischer's stance. First of all, you could make a contradicting argument. You could say, does it really make sense that out of the blue, one leader could say, okay, everybody, we're all davening three times a day. You're going to have to come to shul three times a day, and you're going to have to say this text. Does that make any sense? Ezra Fleischer even goes so far as to extend this logic to like Kriya Shema. He says it must be that he instituted like basically half the Siddur, Kriya Shema and Shemaine Esrei in Yavne. Does that make sense? The Jewish people was never doing any form of worship beforehand. Everyone was complacent with sending the Matzah to Shekel. And out of the blue, you have to go to shul for 2 hours a day. Does that make sense? Is that really logical? That's the first, a perplexing thing about this idea. Yes, the Gemara says it, but is it historical? Is that actually what happened? Or is that just like a kind of historical gist of it that the Gemara is giving you? Ezra Fleischer believes that Brisa is historical. However, across the pond in Oxford, Stefan Reif, and in America, Ruth Langer and Reuven Kimmelman took Ezra Fleischer to task. Stefan Reif, first of all, argued on methodological grounds. He says you can't bring Reyes from right. First of all, you have no evidence whatsoever of this positivistic form. Besides this Brisa, there's no other evidence at all that he made as Nusach HaKeva. And second of all, methodologically, this is just not good method. Give me 1 second to pause because we're gonna have to continue upstairs. 1 second. Okay, sorry if anybody's confused over video. They just started our VT downstairs, so we just have to continue upstairs here in the office. All right, so first of all, where were we? Professor Reif argued with Ezra Fleischer on methodological grounds. It's very difficult to date Brisas, and the murkiness of the Tanakh era history and our inability to properly construct an accurate history of that era, and many of the historical claims that Ezra Fleischer made, and a lot of the circular reasoning he took issue with. Ruth Langer went further. Ruth Langer argued with Ezra Fleischer misvara. Like she actually went full in on the machlekes. You know, let's argue in the sugya. She argues on svara. She argues and she brings other rayas against him, and she really just took him to force. She does an English review. She does a Hebrew. She does more than one response to Ezra Fleischer. I'm not sure if he took it personally or not, but it was quite the controversy. It was quite a like tumult that she was taking on Ezra Fleischer. It's interesting, in Eretz Yisrael, like other people like Uri Erlich and others followed, even Yisrael Tashma, they followed Ezra Fleischer's. They actually accepted his core premise. They had some issues with it, but they accepted his core premise. Langer completely took him to town, and many of her arguments are on the basis of available evidence. One of the most impressive arguments she takes against Ezra Fleischer's assertion is that if you isolate just the Tannaic era data, right? Let's just take the Brises and Teseftas that we have. And she was working about 15 years later, roughly 15, 20 years after Ezra Fleischer's initial paper. We got a lot more data. There was better research on certain Brises, better research on certain Teseftas, and there was just better, we had better versions of the data that we needed. And she says, if we take just the Tanaic information, the information from the time of the Tanaim, whether it's Midrashim, whether it's Teseftas, whether it's Brises, whatever it is, Mishnayos, if we take just that information, we isolate this so-called Brisa from Bavli about Shimon HaPakoli, we say that never existed. What would we know from the era of the Tanaim? Well, we have many Gemaras about Tanaim saying Shemayin Esrei's that are too long, Shemayin Esrei's that are too short, embellishing, making Shemayin Esrei's in their own way. In other words, there's a lot of liturgical flexibility. Some people said you had to do Me'ein Shemayin Esrei. Some people said you had to do the whole Shemayin Esrei. There's a machlokes between Rabbi Yeshua and Gamaliel if you even need to do Arvit or not. So most of the evidence that we have from that era, especially evidence from Rabbi Eliezer and other Tanaim, would seem to demonstrate that the Tanaim had their own chazanim who would compose their own Shemayin Esrei's, and there was different types. There was perhaps they kept the order, but there were different nuschais of the brachais, and nobody seemed to care. Nobody ever asked Akasha, like, oh, but why did you not do it the way Rabbi Gamliel Yabnis did it? There was never Akasha. It was never like, for example, we have a Tesefta that says that you could, this is a Tesefta on Gimel Chav Hei. There's a Tesefta which says, well, you could combine these two brachas together. You could combine these two brachas together, let's say, L'kei David U'Bayna Yushalayim, and you're still Yaitse. Right, there's a Tesefta which explicitly says you could, you know, these six brachas you could combine and you're still Yaitse, you could separate. But some people, you know, if you do it this way, it's fine. If you do it that way, it's fine. Clearly, there was liturgical flexibility in the time of the Tanaim. So she completely doesn't buy that there was a fixed text written down on a piece of paper and published to Klal Yisrael. She just doesn't buy that. And also based on work from Reuven Kimmelman, he also doesn't really accept Ezra Fleischer's core theory. As far as I can tell, Kimmelman doesn't seem to accept that as his core theory, even though Fleischer's subsequent contributions after his core premise and theory were very useful because his studies of the Shemaine Esrei, once he takes that as a premise, his analyses of Shemaine Esrei as a liturgical rubric and the design of Shemaine Esrei is very valuable because he does a lot of work on it post that premise, which is very valuable. And we're going to discuss as we go through the Shemaine Esrei. Lastly, just most recently, the most recent work is from certain scholars in Eretz Yisrael who are finally taking the middle approach. David Henschke is the Talmud expert at Bar Ilan, and he's essentially like a kind of Reish Yeshiva there. And it's really impossible to explain what kind of genius he is in Kolatera Kula. Like, there's literally not I can't explain with words. There's not a stone unturned. It's not that he knows Shas. He knows Shas forward and backward and inside out. He knows Yushami forward, inside, and he's not a normal human being. David Henschke is one of those people that when he talks, you listen, because his arguments are like Ezra Fleischer, just from a Talmudic perspective. When he's arguing with you on a sugya, you have to listen to David Henschke, because David Henschke is one of the greatest geniuses alive today when it comes to learning Gemara. There's very few people alive who can think like a Rishon, and David Henschke is one of those people. And I don't say that lightly, because I've seen Achrayim, I've seen Rishonim, I've learned from a lot of people. When you learn from David Henschke and you learn and you read some of the pieces, some of the drushes that he puts out, some of his papers, you realize that there are very few people who could learn at that level around today. It's absolutely incredible. Now, he's also, of course, aware of this entire, because as I said, he leaves no stone unturned. He's read every single book. He's read every single paper. He's read every single footnote of every single paper inside and out since 1785, every Rishon and Achrayim, he knows it. He takes every piece of evidence up until academic times, whether it's rabbinic evidence, Christian evidence, whatever it is, he knows it and he uses it. And he takes a middle ground approach, which I find is very interesting. He takes this middle ground approach that we can't necessarily know the truth of whether, let's say, Fleischer is correct or Langer is correct, whether there was a Nusach HaKeva or there was no Nusach HaKeva. We can never know. There's going to be a murkiness. But Ezra Fleischer's main premise is built on the idea that you cannot have a Chiddush of Tfilas HaKeva, right, a Tfilas HaKeva, without a Nusach HaKeva. That's Ezra Fleischer's automatic assumption, right? That you just can't have such a thing. How could you institute a prayer for all of Klai Yisrael and not create a Nusach HaKeva? So Henschke says, well, wait a second. Maybe Heinemann is right. Maybe there was a lot of flexibility. Maybe there was many brachas that assembled at once. But what was the chiddush of Shemaine Esrei? What was the core chiddush? The core chiddush was something a lot more technical. And you have to think like a lamdan to think like this. All of the brachos that we have prior to Shemaine Esrei it's in like Talmudic terms, you would say it's geboitan amaisa, right? You would say that it's dependent on an event. It's dependent on an action. Whether it's a public tainus, you would say six blessings in the Beis HaMikdash. Whether it's a Torah reading by Hakel, you would say, I think it was five blessings. Whether it was the Kohen Gadol on Yom Kippur, he would say eight blessings, as the Mishnah says in Yoma. Let's think of another example. Berachas HaMazon, hearing the bracha for thunder or lightning, whatever it was. Most of the blessings that we have that we had in Jewish liturgy were tied to actions, occurrences, or events. That was how liturgy was understood. It was never obligatory, and there was never a blessing that was independent of any time, place, or action. However, Rabbi Gamliel's chiddush is that there should be a bracha, such a thing as a series of brachas, for no other reason than to worship God. Not that everybody had to say a Nusach HaKeva, but the nusach of roughly 18 brachas that people were already saying was going to become an obligation. Meaning, there were many different brachas that were said and that were being collected from different social circles in Eretz Yisrael. But many of these were being said in communal worships already. And the action of Rabbi Gamliel B'Yavne was to coalesce all of these things and say, to coalesce all of these brachas and say that these 18, that 18 topics have to be discussed in a specific order. And it was going to be based on the worship in the Beis HaMikdash. In other words, he was trying to give everybody a pseudo Beis HaMikdash type service in his era that would satisfy the needs of Klal Yisrael after the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash. Now, it's not clear if he believes that Rabbi Gamliel was actually, to me, I didn't get to every footnote in that paper, my apologies, but I'm not sure if he believes that Rabbi Gamliel fixed the number of 18. Essentially, what he does is that he tries to demonstrate how the Shemayna Esrei was dialogic. It's like kind of like a conversation. It begins with the first three are praise to God. Then comes the petitions of Klal Yisrael. Then comes the Thanksgiving. Finally comes Berachos Kehanim. Why does Berachos Kehanim come at the end of Shemayna Esrei? Why does Berachos Kehanim come at the end? Because in the Beis HaMikdash it came at the end. At the end of the series of blessings that were said, or at the end of Karbanos in the Beis HaMikdash, was the Berachos Kehanim. The Kahal would come forth and worship, and then the Kehanim would go and respond to the Kahal with a blessing from Hashem. And in the Beis HaMikdash, the service was dialogic. Therefore, what Rabbi Gamliel B'Yavne was doing was taking an existing selection of brachos that had often been put together in a series, and he was closing it out with a Birchas Kehanim as a communal worship, and creating such like a bracha like Sim Shalom at the end as a substitute for when there was no communal worship. Meaning, Shemayna Esrei existed in some form in the time before Rabbi Gamliel, right? There was a collection of brachos, but what were you going to do if you were individual? Nobody had an obligation to pray, so there was no such a thing as a bracha like Sim Shalom. It just didn't exist. The tefillah would have ended with something like Maidim. The Maidim would have been the end of these series in brachos, or some people might have ended their series of brachos with Shemayat Tefillah, Baruch Atah Hashem Shemayat Tefillah, just like the bracha at the end of Yom Kippur davening ends with. Either you ended with Shemayat Tefillah, or you ended with Tov Lecha L'Haydais, like the end of Maidim. But the Berachos Kehanim was added because to the fixed liturgy by Rabbi Gamliel, because he wanted to create a fixed type of prayer that even there was an obligation on the Kahal, even if they didn't have Kehanim. And this led to the creation of Sim Shalom. And then later, when Sim Shalom began being said, even when there were no Kehanim, they decided to fix Birchas Haminim into its own bracha to maintain the number of 18. In other words, Henschke is trying to say that this is more complicated than we know. But you don't have to say, I'm sorry that this is a little long-winded, we're all the way here at the end, but it's more complicated than we know. B, the core argument that you have to have a Nusach HaKeva isn't really there. It's quite likely that there was a form of the Amida that existed pre-Rabbi Gamliel. He didn't really have to create something out of nothing. And it's quite possible that many synagogues, many people were reciting a series of brachos. The chiddush was that brachos could be used even without an event, even without a place or a time. Brachos could be used independently for nothing. Three times a day, talk to your maker. Three times a day, worship Hashem. That was the chiddush of Rabbi Gamliel, and therefore, in the time of Yavne, roughly 18 brachos became fixed. That's the middle ground approach, and we're going to examine it more closely as we go through all the brachos, and we're going to have to go through these three approaches roughly. So again, let's just take the three approaches, and we're going to discuss. In the coming shurim, let's call it the philological approach, the form critical approach, and finally the middle ground. The original approach was Rabbi Gamliel did nothing. This is all a myth. Rabbi Gamliel maybe added Berachos Haminim, but these brachos, you know, coalesced at different times. That's the first theory. The second theory is that No, Rabbi Gamliel did something. He set an order of the Shemayin Esrei, but he never fixed the Nusach HaKeva. It was just something that was an order that was dictated, and everybody kind of got together and chose the best versions of each bracha to fit that order of 18 that Rabbi Gamliel proposed. Lastly, there's a middle ground that perhaps he did that. Philological, form critical. Then we have as four. Ezra Fleischer goes ahead and says, no, there wasn't a Nusach HaKeva. It was something from nothing. There was a paper written where they made an edict. You have to say these 18 brachos with this Nusach HaKeva, a strong traditionalist approach. This is like you take somebody who's completely irreligious and he starts talking like a rebbe. That's Ezra Fleischer, not completely irreligious, but like someone like it's just so funny that Ezra Fleischer took such a hardcore traditionalist approach. And then lastly, we have some sort of middle ground approach, which just accepts that there must have been a strong edict from Gamliel, but not that necessarily it was a Nusach HaKeva. However, the value of seeing that there was a strong edict in Yavne, that there was some strong leadership in Yavne, is that, I'm losing my train of thought. The value that there's a strong edict in Yavne gives you the ability to start studying the Amidah as having a set structure, as not just being like the philologists think, a random occurrence of a bunch of brachas that are haphazardly put one after the other. No, in Yavne, they consciously put these brachas one after the other. There are sets of three at the beginning, three at the end. The 12 in the middle, and there's a deliberate order, and there was a deliberate composition centrally. Now, that's so much for the history of both Shemayin Esrei and where modern scholarship is holding and how they think Shemayin Esrei developed. Does any of this matter? Probably not. This is material. Most of the material that makes this argument go back and forth is limited, finite. We're getting better versions of it here and there. But most of this material is stuff we're going to see as we go forward. Now, it's just very, very useful to know as we study Shemayin Esrei bracha by bracha, it's very useful to have an educated opinion about the different methods of approaching the brachas of Shemayin Esrei. We have to understand when we're bringing a raya from somebody, whether it's an Abu Dirham, whether it's a Yosef Heinemann, whoever it is, over the past 1,000 years, we have to keep the perspective of how they understood the bracha of Shemayin Esrei and its place within the broader 18. So knowing these methods is very important for our studies going forward. Lastly, is the obvious silence. After the, let's call it the Chachamim in Yavne, when it comes to a textual history, a textual record of Shemayin Esrei, there's roughly 800 years of silence. We do not have a written record of what the Shemayin Esrei should look like until the 800s. So what exactly happened? So just to summarize our first class, the Siddur of History, in 30 seconds, essentially what happened was is that Jews are always very averse to writing. According to some, Jews refrained from writing prayers at all. Writing Torah Shebaal Peh for sure. Writing the Oral Torah was probably forbidden. But writing prayers, according to some, writing prayers was also a something forbidden by the rabbis. Some say that when it says Kaisvei Brachis Kesarfei Torah, it doesn't just mean tefillahs; it really means kameas. It means like amulets. But many of the Gaonim at least understood Kaisvei Brachis Kesarfei Torah to mean that you're not allowed to write down prayers. So until the 800s, we really don't have any record of the prayers and how they were written until the time of Rav Nachshon Goyen and Rav Amram Goyen. Also, one other aspect brought by Professor Reif is that the Jews also did not start using the codex as opposed to a scroll or wax tablets until much later than the Christians. The Christians adopted the codex right away because they were not averse to writing. They liked history. They liked, they thought history was important, and they liked writing as much as possible, and they loved the idea of a codex. The Jewish scholars, of course, did not. They did not like writing. They thought that everything had to be memorized. and holy scriptures had to be in scrolls. And if you had to write something down that was searchable, it would be on a wax tablet, and then it could actually erase it later if you didn't need it. Therefore, it wasn't until the Codex was adopted by the academies in roughly the 800s or 900s that something like a Siddur could have taken place. And that's when we get our first textual evidence of versions of the Shemayna Esrei. That 800 years of silence makes it perhaps almost impossible to reconstruct the earliest version of Shemayna Esrei as it was in Yavne. We have some hints to the ideas of the Shemayna Esrei from Piyutim, from poetry, from roughly the 500s or the 600s, but we do not have a complete picture of what the Nusach of Shemayna Esrei was for roughly 800 years. This makes the study of the Ur text, the original text, darn near impossible. And every scholar recognizes this problem. And therefore, we cannot talk about Shemayna Esrei in the terms of definite known texts, but we can speak of it in terms of a known order and of a known structure. Okay, so with that, we're going to complete our shiur on the introduction to the Shemayna Esrei. And I hope in the coming weeks, we will discuss all the next 18 brachot. I'm not sure how we're going to do this, if we're going to do rubrics of bracha at a time, if we're going to how much of the text we're going to discuss, but we're going to get through it. Bezrat Hashem. I'm conflicted, actually, whether or not we should continue next week with the Shemona Esrei itself, or if we should continue with something more Pesach themed. So I'll get the input from everybody.
A question.
One second. I'll get feedback from everybody if they want to discuss Pesach.